The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one. From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
As demonstrated by the iconic statue in Arlington, Virginia, the Battle of Iwo Jima produced a lasting moment in the Pacific campaign during World War II. Iwo Jima was the only U.S. Marine battle against the Japanese that had more American casualties than Japanese casualties. Nowhere was this loss more evident than in Fox Company 2nd Battalion 26th Marines, which suffered the highest rate of Marines killed in action of any Marine company in U.S. history. Commanding that company was then Captain Frank C. Caldwell, who by the end of the battle found himself fighting with no officers and very few NCOs remaining. Still, Fox Company captured more ground than any other Marine company on Iwo Jima. For his valor, Caldwell was decorated with the Navy Cross along with the Purple Heart. In this episode, now retired Colonel Frank Caldwell sits down with guest host Dr. Lewis Sorley to recount his experiences. The conversation begins with Caldwell explaining his origins, growing up in a rather crowded household.
Well, I was born in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And I was educated there in Spartanburg, and from there I went to Davidson College in North Carolina, where I graduated and I got a commission in the U.S. Army then through the ROTC program.
What was your family background? Were there any military people in among your antecedents?
No, there was, to my knowledge, there were no military people connected in any way preceding me or else. I had brothers and sisters in the armed forces during World War II.
What number were you amongst the brothers and sisters?
I was number 8 of 9.
Wow. Almost the baby.
Almost the baby, yes.
Yeah. What was the spread amongst first to last of those 9
children?
Well,
when I was born, my oldest sister was 21 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
And my youngest sister was 2 years younger than I was.
Yeah. So
we had a spread of 5 sons and 3 daughters.
What a great family. What a great family. So did you have a good experience at Davidson? Was that a good choice for you?
Now that I've grown older, I appreciate the fact that I was allowed to go to Davidson. I wanted to go to another college, but my father and one of my brothers decided, they think, due to my personality and abilities, I should go to a small school. And Davidson would be the choice. And that was over in North Carolina. It was a school of about 650 boys.
Yes.
At that time. And I was a member of the fraternity there, and I played football. I was captain of the football team my senior year.
What position did you play?
I played center.
Okay.
And I backed up the line.
Yep. Yeah, it went both ways in those days, of course.
Yes, we did.
Yes. Now, did you say that you received an Army commission?
I did receive an Army commission, but yeah. I was lucky enough to be accepted in the Marine Corps in a program they had back in those days where there would be two students. One would be the primary, the other would be the alternate. I was the primary.
Yes.
And I went directly after graduation. About a month after graduation, I had about a month layoff to go to Quantico, Virginia.
What year did you graduate, sir?
1942.
And what pulled you to the Marine Corps? What attracted you?
Well, the uniform.
I can understand that.
I just thought it would be a challenge, it would be a good service, and then I was not wrong.
No, of course you weren't wrong. Where did you go after your initial training?
My initial training was at Quantico in the officer's course there, and I decided to be a parachutist.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to airborne training at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and got my parachute wings and My first assignment was overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Went to was ordered to join the 1st Marine Parachute Battalion, which was then located at New Caledonia.
Mm-hmm.
And it just come out of Guadalcanal and Tulagi and Gavutu operations, and were there at a camp in New Caledonia, and that's where I joined them. It took 21 days on a ship, on a merchant ship. We stopped by Samoa to drop off some aircraft. It was about 11 aircraft were dropped off, and I got a chance to see some of the Samoans down there, and that was my first taste to the South Pacific.
Yeah.
And we went from there to a port called Noumea in New Caledonia, which New Caledonia being a French colony.
Yes. Now, tell us a little about the 1st Marine Parachute Battalion. Had they made combat jumps?
No, this parachute battalion did not make any combat jumps. It was mainly used for amphibious operations.
Right.
And it had been used at in Guadalcanal, at Gavutu and Tulagi.
Mm-hmm.
Those are small operations, but they and the raiders led the way in the 1st Marine Division into those islands there.
When you arrived, were you assigned as a platoon leader? What duties did you have?
Well, the first assignment I had, I was a platoon leader, but very briefly, and then I was moved up to the executive officer of A Company, 1st Parachute Battalion.
Okay. And what was the first action you saw?
We were sent to Guadalcanal, which was still going on
uh-huh.
at the time, and we got involved in the defense of Guadalcanal before going on up into the further north in the Solomon Islands. And there were a number of islands there which I had never heard before that we went to. An island called Vela La Vela, a very romantic-sounding island. It had a few Japanese on there. But we were set up there as sort of to it'd be a jumping-off place from there to further north, to further out to other islands. And we went from Vela La Vela to Bougainville.
Yeah.
And Bougainville turned out to be our big first combat.
Yes. Now, are we into 1943 by now?
We're in 43, yes.
Yes. Yeah. So tell us a little about the other Marines that you encountered then, and your company commander and the Marines in your company.
Well, the most of them were pretty rugged types. They were very gung-ho, as the word goes, and our parachute companies were a little smaller, say, than a regular infantry company, but we
mm-hmm.
really were maneuver around being small and
yeah.
were working in small groups like squads and so forth.
Would I be right in thinking that the people in the parachute units had volunteered for that duty?
All of them had been volunteered, yes. It was a very rugged type training, and I enjoyed it.
Yes. But we're now not doing any airborne operations. We're slogging it out on the ground. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. When did you see your first Japanese?
I saw my first Japanese on Vela La Vela. He was an aviator. Japanese aviator had been shot down, and he had swam ashore to Vela La Vela, and we met him as he came ashore. And we sort of used some baling wire, which we found around him, bailed up his. We didn't have any ropes or anything like that, so we tied him up with this baling wire, and he was a little bit concerned about his welfare, you know, what we were going to do with him.
Yes.
And first thing I know, we had our Japanese interpreter to come down, a major, who was a graduate of Oxford, and he was very well trained in Japanese, could speak very well. He was did go to the University of Tokyo also. But he didn't like the way we were treating this this prisoner, so he backed us away and took the baling wire off of the Japanese, and offered him a cigarette and let him smoke, and he enjoyed that. And he looked around at our interpreter, looked around at us and said, see there, that's the way you treat these people. But we were not too well trained on how to capture, to deal with them.
Well, and your first Japanese, you're probably a little apprehensive about the whole matter anyway.
That's right.
What were the young Marines like? Were they in their teens still, most of them? Or
I would say the average age was about 18 or 19 years old, very, very young.
Yes.
And there were a few in the non-commissioned officer category, and in the officers, our age probably was in the low 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I was 21 myself.
Older fellow. Now there came a point, I think, sir, when the parachute units were deactivated. Is that right?
Yes, they were.
And was that in the midst of these campaigns?
Well, yes, it took place at Bougainville in the month of February, I believe, of 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And we got the word that we were going to be disbanded. And returned to the States. Huh. Well, nobody seemed to worry about going back to the States. In fact, we looked forward to it.
And, could handle that.
We could handle that pretty well. And so we did. We went back to the States and found ourselves at Camp Pendleton, California. That's when I joined the 5th Marine Division.
Yes. And what assignment did you receive there?
I received shortly after joining the 5th Division, I was first assigned as an executive officer of a rifle company.
Yes.
In the 3rd Battalion of the 26th Marines, Marine Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
In about a month's time, I was promoted to captain and then assigned as a company commander of Fox Company of the 2nd Battalion, 26th Marines.
Now you're in for it.
I'm in for it.
When we return, Colonel Caldwell tells us about his training in Hawaii in preparation for the amphibious assault on Iwo Jima.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are. Through your MP3 player. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes. The Veterans Chronicles podcast. Now online at radioamerica.org.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Earlier in this edition, Colonel Frank Caldwell took us through his earlier campaigns as a member of the 1st Marine Parachute Battalion. Now Caldwell tells us about the build-up to his time at Iwo Jima, starting with his first impressions of the company he would later lead.
I joined a company which was a kind of a bunch of characters. They were former raiders and former parachutists.
All right.
About a quarter of that company was of that ilk.
Yes.
And
a little leadership challenge for you.
That's right. And a lot of them were like the old professional baseball players. They didn't want to train too much, but they'd rather maybe sit around and wait for happy hour. So when we left there, and we did very intensive training, both all levels, at squad or fire team, squad, platoon, company, and so forth, there with combined arms and the tanks and artillery and so forth. So we were really ready to go when the time came. We were making a big amphibious assault on the Pacific coast there. In the presence of President Roosevelt.
He
came out and was sitting in a straight chair up on a sand dune watching us land.
Really?
And we didn't know what that was for, but he was just inspecting his troops to see how they worked. He had a fondness for the Marine Corps. He had a son in the Marine Corps named Jimmy.
And he'd been an assistant secretary of the Navy, of course.
Yes, he had.
Yeah.
But it wasn't too long after he witnessed that landing, and we were called away emergency to go back to camp, pack up, and get aboard ship.
Head for the war again.
We did. We went back out again. Although we did not go very far, we went as far as Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Went to a camp there at on the big island of Hawaii called Camp Taro. And that's where we began very intensive training. We didn't know what we were training for, but...
Didn't know where you were headed.
Didn't know where we were heading.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, that was a dark secret for many months.
Yeah.
It wasn't until we got aboard ship did they announce where we what our target was. And I learned where we were going a little ahead of the time because I had a brother in the Navy mm-hmm. who was a gunnery officer on a destroyer, and they were in the Pearl Harbor area, and he called me, got in touch with me, and wanted to meet with me and say hello, and we got together, and he informed me where our division was going. I said, first I've heard of it. And so he...
You had your own intelligence network.
He had all the charts out in his stateroom, and he says, you're going to this position, this island here. I said, what's the name of it? He says, Iwo Jima.
Hmm.
Said, well, so his ship was assigned to Iwo Jima as well. They performed the job of a picket ship.
Yes.
Out from Iwo, about 50 miles.
Now, that's quite remarkable. You and your brother wound up in this campaign together.
Yeah, we had lunch together there. Nice meeting. And there were three of us in the service in my family. My brother Jim was in the Navy, and Bill, who was in the Army Air Corps, and I was in the Marine Corps.
You had a multi-service team right there in your family, didn't you? Now, when it came time to go, what happened? You got does the whole division go together?
Yeah, well, we went by regiments.
Right.
On an APA, you know, it took care of one battalion.
Attack transports, I remember those.
Mm-hmm.
And did you go directly from the APA to the assault? Did you get into landing craft off of that vessel? How did it work?
Well, it took 20-some-odd days to make the trip.
Yes.
All the way from Pearl Harbor. We went by way of Inuitok and Saipan, and we did some landings there.
All right.
Practice landings.
Practice landings. Mm-hmm. When did the troops find out where you were going?
They found out the day that I found out,
uh-huh.
in quotes.
Uh-huh.
They broke out all the training aids and maps and all the charts, and the orders started filtering down and the scheme of maneuver and all that stuff.
Yes.
The troops learned of that, and they were somewhat excited.
I'm sure they were very excited. But it was tough duty ahead, I know that.
Yes.
Tell us.
We didn't know exactly. We had some aerial photographs of the island and saw the emplacements.
Yes.
And how many they had there and how they were dug in. And it was...
It was formidable, wasn't it?
Very formidable.
Tell us what happened then, please, when the landings began. You get into... What do you get into? A smaller landing craft?
Well, we did. We went from our ship. We went ashore by LCVP, the small landing craft for personnel. And we landed in the afternoon on D-Day.
Did you have your whole company together in one craft?
No, we had it split up, I think, a platoon per LCVP.
All right.
And so we had to stay pretty close together in formation as we went in.
Yes.
We all landed fairly close together. We didn't have many mishaps on that. All any boats astray or landing craft astray. We landed together and went to our objective right away, which is across the island, about 800 yards, right across the neck of the island,
uh-huh.
Ujima.
Okay.
And I was there. I took 258 Marines and Navy corpsmen, and this included the officers, 258 ashore.
After the break, Colonel Caldwell continues the story of the epic Battle of Iwo Jima. Stay with us.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Colonel Frank Caldwell landed on Iwo Jima on February 19, 1945, where he and his Marines met a ferocious Japanese resistance. In the next segment, Caldwell concludes his story of the grueling month-long battle on the island. We pick up the story as Caldwell and his men make their first advances on the Japanese stronghold.
We then went through our zone of action to the island, and the company I had, Fox Company, was the 26th Marines. Turned out to be, I didn't realize that when the fighting was taking place, but we did run into some resistance along the way. We took some casualties on about the 26th of February. We ran into a pocket of resistance, and when you're in the offensive like this, you don't have much cover.
No, you got it.
So naturally, the offense is pretty dangerous.
You bet.
So we took on 59 casualties that day.
Wow.
In a company.
Wow.
And that was one of our biggest days where we took on casualties. And the next biggest day was the 3rd of March, which we were getting further up to the north against the Japanese. Well, all of them were well dug in. They had excellent bunkers, concrete,
yes,
and they were spider traps and so forth,
yes,
firing out of them. You couldn't see what they were doing. You go across a little ravine or something, and you see a pile of Marines, dead Marines, piled up right there where they crossed that ravine, and the Japanese were picking us up down that gully.
And filleted fire as you went through.
Yeah, on the flanks.
Yes. Did you have flamethrowers?
Yes, we did. My company had, several flamethrowers. We had explosives. We had reckless rifles, as we call them, the 2.36 inch rifle.
Recoilless rifle, right.
Recoilless rifles.
Yes.
And we had three rifle platoons of 39 Marines each, and they were divided up into squads and fire teams.
Right.
And we had a machine gun. The machine gun platoon was about the biggest. It had a number of Browning machine guns, water-cooled, and for defense purposes mainly, and then we had the air-cooled A-4 machine guns. We had one BAR, Browning automatic rifle, in each fire team.
Yes. Were you receiving any replacements for these high level of casualties?
Yes, we did receive a considerable number of replacements. They would usually join us in the evening hours, and we had problems at first with them getting acquainted with the situation and working their way in to the squads. And some of them got a little, their morale was a little bit low. So we decided we'd buck them up a little bit, so we put some black tape around their helmets, around this way and across the front, on top rather, and across the side.
Right.
And that was Fox Company. It was the 26th Marine. And you see that around, you know that was that company.
One of my guys.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that helped a lot. I once had a replacement to come up to me, and my nickname on Iwo was Butch. And this young harried Marine was saying, "I'm looking for Butch. I'm looking for Butch. Where's Butch?" I said, "I'm Butch." And he says, "Butch, he just sort of crumbled in front of him." He says, I can't take it anymore. I said, well, I gave him the old treatment there and pat him on the back and told him what a good job he's doing. And I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you on R&R right now, and you go right behind that and join my 60-millimeter mortars, and you'll have fun with them. And so he did. Thank you so much. And he went back to Africa.
That was R&R.
That was R&R.
That was good thinking on your part.
Yeah.
Now, this has got to be the action in which you received the Navy Cross.
Yes.
And you're also wounded, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us that story, please.
Well, the Navy Cross, I guess, was a, the culmination of the fact that I was leading my company. I'd lost all my officers killed. I had no leadership down the chain.
Yes.
And so I managed to lead this company through some terrible fortifications. And we captured more territory than any other outfit on Iwo Jima. We took more casualties than any outfit on, like outfit, any yes. company on
yes.
Iwo Jima. I landed with 258, and out of that 258, we left on March the 26th, which was considered the last day for us.
Yes.
With 20.
Whoa.
20 Marines.
Wow.
And that's 20 of the original 258.
Right. Right.
The Navy Cross was the result of those two surges we made against the Japanese and capturing some vital territory up there. Key points.
Yes.
Hill 362, which was known throughout. And the Purple Heart was, I got that when we were in the attack. I got hit in the leg, in the thigh, with a shrapnel from a bursting artillery round.
Mm-hmm.
But turned myself into the sick bay, and they patched me up and said, "You seem to be pretty well," and I didn't miss a beat. I was right back in.
Now, this is also, I want to point out for our listeners, this is sustained combat. This is more than a month of this very tough duty.
It was. We had very little rest.
Yeah.
We would think that just moving back about 20 yards and get behind a rock,
yeah.
a big boulder was... That was rest.
That was a break.
That was a big break.
What was the weather like?
The weather was actually not bad as far as the temperature or rain is concerned. It was at night it got cool, and when we dig down in our foxholes, it was awfully hot down in there with that sulfuric fumes coming up.
Now, you talk about digging foxholes. This is pretty rocky terrain, isn't it?
Well, it was. It was rocky, but we found a few spots in there we could scratch in.
And you're highly motivated, I'm sure, to do that.
Right. How about, we didn't stay in those foxholes too long.
How about food and so on?
We had our regular rations, regular key rations that we had. And we never had any garrison-type rations.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Stuff boiling in a pot.
Adequate water?
We had adequate water, but the poor Japanese did not. They, in fact, that's one of the things that defeated the Japanese on Iwo, the fact that they became so dehydrated.
Yeah.
That they just couldn't make it.
I hadn't heard that
coming
before.
Out and shaking cans at night, trying to get our water.
Really?
And I had, toward the end there, I had four Japanese come out of a cave, and they were dressed in loincloths. But they were so emaciated that so I gave them a drink of water.
Yeah,
I was all heart.
Well, what was the situation after this? Looks like about 5 weeks of a very tough duty there. When you withdrew, what was the situation then? Did you go back on ship? Late March.
Late March, yes. We were pulled out of the front, up in the front line. We went all the way, my company went all the way up to the tip, northern tip of Iwo Jima. We were fighting Japanese up there who were in caves.
Mm-hmm.
And they would fire these little, what we call knee mortars.
Yes.
There was a small, there's nothing but looked like a grenade on being fired out of a tube.
Mm-hmm.
And we had they call that area the gorge, and you couldn't take tanks down in there. But we managed to get down in there and pick out the Japanese we wanted to in these caves. We would assault the caves with reckless recoilless rifles and satchel charges and
yes.
flamethrowers.
Yes.
We made maximum use of flamethrowers, both in the tanks. We had flamethrower tanks,
yes.
which were very effective, too. They could throw a flame out about 100 yards.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I was with a tank when it was with us to support us in attacking a cave, Japanese in there, and the Japanese came out behind their officer who was brandishing a samurai sword, and he was yelling, "Banzai, Banzai, Banzai," and ran right toward the tank. The tank had the barrel pointing toward him, and all the tank commander had to do was push that button, and he got the flame out. Just immersed this officer, wow. charging officer with his 10 Japanese behind him with flame, bursts of flame, and they caught on fire, and he went on down. His sword was on fire. Because he had that napalm on it, and
sure.
and he charged into the deck. That was a sad little story.
Terrible thing to have to witness.
But anyway, to answer the question there, we went back aboard ship at about March the 26th, which would be about 5 weeks.
Yes.
We loaded on an LST, which came in. Into the beach.
Yes.
Dropped its ramp, and they took us out to the transport.
And
we said goodbye to Iwo Jima.
And, yeah. Not too sorry to do that, I'm sure, either.
I spent the first few days or weeks, you wouldn't believe it, but I was the only company commander left in our battalion.
Wow.
And I was directed to write letters of condolence
yes.
to next of kin.
Yes.
So I had to write these in my own handwriting. And you had to write them in triplicate. So that's three times 100. My wrist was sore writing the next of kin.
What a sad duty.
It was sad, and I got a lot of responses.
Did you?
Yeah. Yes.
What about your wound? Were you healing up by now?
Yes, I was.
And was that the end of combat for you, for that unit, or did you reconstitute and go further?
Well, we went back to Hawaii.
Yes.
Back to our camp.
Yes, Tarawa.
And, reconstituted and reformed and got ready for the next engagement, which would never occurred. Of course, we were sent to Japan.
Yes. Fortunately, we did not have to make that invasion.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, you became a professional Marine, of course.
Yes, I did.
Did you stay in touch with some of the people who survived in that outfit with you?
And certainly did. We managed to have get-togethers and reunions every year.
Yes.
I haven't missed a year yet.
How terrific.
The line is getting very thin.
Well, inevitably. But that camaraderie formed in tough circumstances is very strong, isn't it?
Yes. And,
yes.
We help each other out. We have to. But it's been a good life. I've had a good career in the Marine Corps. And I can't fault that at all.
Well, I don't know how you could top the story you've just told, but I think you served also in Korea. Is that not so?
I certainly did. I was an executive officer of a battalion. 2nd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment.
And in what part of the Korean War did you serve?
That was the last phase of it.
Uh-huh.
It was in the bunker phase when we were lobbing shots back and forth.
Yes.
Between bunkers.
Yes. And then you continued on. Obviously, you reached the rank of colonel. What was your last assignment in the Marine Corps?
My last assignment was the director of Marine Corps history.
Really?
Yes.
What a great job that was.
As a matter of fact, I had that for 10 years.
Yes. And where was the history office at that time?
It was at headquarters, Marine Corps.
Yeah. And
it was in the old building that in the Navy Annex building in Henderson Hall. right next to the Arlington Cemetery.
Yes.
Very appropriate.
Yes, very, and I know it well. You might even have superintended the writing of some of the history you'd helped to make.
I haven't. So yeah, we wrote five volumes on World War II.
Yes.
And they were very big volumes, 2 or 3 inches thick. And,
yes.
And I had, I didn't write them, but I
superintended.
I did, yes.
Yes. That's terrific. Is there anything else you'd like to say about reflecting back on your service?
Well, I think of what I did, I satisfied my desire as an adolescent. When I was a real young fella, my greatest desire was to be a Marine officer leading troops in combat. And I got that opportunity. Plus, I got an insight into the other parts of the Marine Corps.
Yes.
And I served with some of the greatest people that I've ever known. And I had the greatest Marines on Iwo that you can imagine. I didn't have anybody that let me down.
And you served with great distinction. Thank you very much for this interview. We've been talking with Colonel Frank Caldwell, United States Marine Corps retired, veteran of World War II and the Korean War. And this is Veterans Chronicle, Louis Sorley. Thank you very much.
Coming up next, this week's Profile in Valor.